You're now listening to The Brian Callen Show with your host, Brian Callen.
Okay, everybody, this is The Brian Callen Show. And I am here in CV Vineyards with Jim Duane, who is, what is your official title?
Winemaker.
Talk into the mic, sir. This is a very big podcast. Saint making wine. You're a winemaker. You are the winemaker for CV Vineyards.
Yeah, so we're a very small, tiny, family-run operation, and so I work for the CV family,
yeah,
growing grapes and making wine.
Yeah, I got to know Jim because he's a listener of the podcast, and he sent me an email after listening to my podcast with Dave Asprey. And Dave Asprey was talking about ochratoxin and how ochratoxin is a mold on coffee and on grains and on wine and how it's really poisonous for you, which is all true. But then Jim basically said that the Europeans don't, I guess, test as readily for California wines. There's very little ochratoxin on California wines because of the sunshine.
I don't think we fully know why there's not the ochratoxin. So the ochratoxin is not the mold itself. It's the product of the mold. And in listening to you and Dave have a conversation, sort of lit me up a little bit, because I know for the wines that we test, because when we send wines to Europe and we sell wines in Europe, we have to, as of 2005, ensure that they don't have a certain level of ochratoxin. And so in the testing that we've done, you know, it's expensive testing. We have to send the samples to an outside lab, and we've never seen ochratoxin. I've never seen ochratoxin.
And it's worth noting, you're a small vineyard, and the process of making wine is so manual. I always say that the reason I love wine so much is because of how much goes into it.
I had a desk job before, but working here, I mean, we lift grapes to get them into the tanks.
Yeah.
We move barrels by hand. This is physical.
And just so you guys know, they take they pick the grapes, and then there's a machine that de-stems them and kind of blows the spiders off and vibrates all the critters off and all that. And then they take those grapes, which are about the size of blueberries,
yep,
and they just whole dump them into stainless steel vats that weigh how much? I mean, how many gallons do they take?
Tiny. So we'll dump a ton of grapes into some of the small tanks, and maybe 4 tons in our biggest tanks.
Yeah, so 4 tons of grapes, and then they let them sit there for, like, you know, 5 weeks sometimes? Or is it that long?
Yeah, so each lot kind of has its own character, and so it's our job to identify that and follow the fermentation and decide how long to stay in the tank before we...
And then you take it, and then you put it in barrels. We went into the barrel room,
yep,
with oak, French oak barrels that cost $1,200 a piece. And they take the oak, and they let it sit for 3 years in the rain, in the sun, and the snow, and the whatever. They let it just sit out there. Then they fashion it into barrels, and then they actually roast it, or they toast it, right?
Yeah, so seasoning is what happens in the yard out in the elements, and then they'll fashion the barrel, and then they'll do the toasting.
And you like using French oak over California oak. Why?
There's a subtlety to the French oak, certain spices that really come forward. They meld well with our wines. It's a certain level of sort of sophistication and refinement that's very specific to not just France, but we will source wood from specific forests in France. So we like to work with wood from Troncay and Allier.
It's pronounced Troncay. Keep going. Jesus. God, Jim.
And yeah, so it's kind of been an iterative process to try different forests, different woods, seasonings, different coopers, and find what are the best sources of wood, of oak, that really make our wines shine.
And they sit in the barrel for 20 months?
Yeah, about 20 months, and in that time, they just go through a sort of a natural clarification, and there's very little work really that happens at that point in time. A couple times a year, we'll come and draw the wine off into a tank and clean out the barrels, because the wines are clarifying, so the solids, the old yeast, the lees, we call it, will settle out, and we'll clean the barrels and put the wine right back in the barrels.
So how do you get the wine from the barrels into the bottles? Do you manually put it in there?
No. So we'll have a truck, big truck and trailer that pulls up onto the property with some really nice equipment. And those guys are pros. They know what they're doing. And so we can get the wine into bottle very fast without any sort of oxygen getting into the wine. And it's very, very clean, very, very nice operation.
And then it continues to age in the bottle. And your wines, according to Robert Parker, and I should mention that the 010 Cabernet Sauvignon got a 97 out of 100 by Robert Parker. And if you guys don't know wine, Robert Parker sets the standard for wine. If you get a 97 from Robert Parker, you're charging $200 a bottle in a restaurant. Easy. Easy. I've seen 97s that go for way more than that. And I know your 96 and your older bottles go for $250, $300 a bottle, just retail. Mm-hmm. But it's well worth it because, you know, for anybody who drinks wines, the wine, this is a compliment to you for sure, but the wine is an old world style of wine. I mean, it's really hard to do that. It's not a typical California cab. And what by that I mean that big in your face jam that, you know, kind of just that big sort of all the berries and blueberries and tar and, you know, I mean,
absolutely.
This is way more subtle and sophisticated.
Yeah, it really reflects the property. We're out here outside of the sort of main path of Napa Valley. We're out in the sticks, we're farming on hillsides.
No cell reception.
It's a rugged place. I mean, yeah. We're dealing with coyotes and turkeys that are eating the grapes. And,
yeah, drunks.
Our wines, you know, we reflect that. We try and make a wine that's rustic, that's big, that has a nod to the old world, that, you know, something that we know from, you know, our history. Our wines are best when they're really laid down and 10, 15 plus years old.
What are your favorite wines? If I gave you, I don't know, $10,000 and you could buy, I don't know, let's call it 10 bottles.
It's such a hard question because
it depends on what kind.
Well, any wine nut is always searching for something new. So if I was going to take your money, thank you, that's generous.
Yeah.
I'm going to go for wines that I've never had before. I mean,
Wine's
kind of this black hole that you can go down and...
But give me an example and give people an example. A lot of people say, I can't tell the difference between a, you know, $40 bottle of wine and $500 bottle of wine. I'm always like, well, I can. I can definitely tell the difference, but I drink enough. But let's take Harlan as a wine that I've seen Harlan's on a wine list for $1,200. I happen to think it's overrated. It's a great wine, but I mean, come on. Then again, I've had Mouton Rothschilds, the 82s that, you know, because my friend made $1 billion and I'll tell you a story about that in a second, but you know, they are every bit, I don't know what they cost, but they're worth it. I mean, and the reason I say that is because when you open a bottle of wine like that and you smell that wine, you never say, oh, that tastes just like, or that smells just like, no, it smells like its own thing. It is so unique. And I had a really weird experience. We opened up one of those bottles. I think we opened a bottle of Angelus or something like 85, some crazy, you know, you can't look at it for under $2,000 or something. And I was drinking it with this very effete, this very gay perfumer. He is the perfumer. He's like the most famous. He makes perfume for like, you know, Versace and Jean-Paul Gaultier. And I mean, he's an amazing dude. And he was breaking. He has a nose. I mean, he's got in some ways the best nose of all time. I mean,
nose being the official term, like an actual
yes.
I mean, this guy is not
and
messing around.
And he makes the cologne and perfume. Mm-hmm. I mean, he makes the most expensive cologne in the world. And in fact, he's so good that really rich people commission him to make their own scents. And his boyfriend came in wearing this. I mean, they both were just as groomed and plucked. And I spent a week with them out in not as their lovers, of course, but just as friends, and out in France. And his boyfriend had his own scent, and I said, "What the hell is that? I don't wear cologne." But I was like, "Bro, I thought I was straight here. I'm smelling it. I'm actually getting turned on. It smelled so good." I said, "What is that?" And he goes, "It's for him. I made it special for him."
Oh,
I was like, "Oh well, can I get some?" "No, I'm sorry. It's just for him. I named it after him." I was like, all right, dude, calm down.
You have to earn it to get your own.
Right. But to have him, I'm getting to a larger point here, to have him break down the wine I was drinking. I mean, he was smelling nutmeg and licorice and chocolate. And as he was saying that, I was like, that's exactly what's in it. The guy was able to, like a dog can break down, like that's how good his nose was. He was like, and he was breaking it down. I went, that's exactly right. I'm tasting nutmeg, licorice, chocolate, some berries, some citrus. It was crazy.
So can I address this?
Yes.
Because this sort of, this gets me going. And I think this is very important. And this is the most common way that people approach wine. And it really, to me, it's a reductionist approach. Mm. You have a wine, you smell it, you taste it, and then you try to identify the components. And some people are very good at that. But I think that ultimately misses the point, and I'll try and answer your question of what are the wines that I would buy with your billionaire money.
What I was getting to is why Harlan over a CV? CV fetches, let's say, $95 a bottle. Harlan fetches $1,000. Screaming Eagle, fetches $2,000. That's where people get lost, and that's what I want to address. But keep talking. I'm sorry.
Sure. So if you smell a wine and you try and break it down to its core components, then you could sort of take that logic to its extreme and say, well, if I were to acquire those components and put them together, then I could remake that wine. If you had perfumer type of access to chemicals and different flavors and smells and all these things, and it just won't work. Mm. You put things together and it's not going to smell like the wine. I think the real story, the real beauty in the wine is not in the pieces coming
the
apart and into the whole. And I think that wine is very seductive for many people because there's all these flavors. There's this sort of this boat, this vessel that you get into, but your experience is part of the experience of the wine. Mm. I mean, we all know that smell that you smell, it comes into your nose, and all of a sudden you have this flash of a memory, something from maybe years or decades ago. Mm. It's a part of your brain. I mean, the limbic system of your brain, where your emotions are, it's very correlated to smell. And you really can't separate smell and emotion very well. So to sort of embrace that and to understand they come together, I think the best wines in the world are wines that remind you of something, or remind you remember where you were when you had that wine, because you had an experience, like you were fully involved, and more just the flavors and the textures, but you remember the people that you were with, you remember loving that experience. To me, that's the
ultimate
goal.
You're using the word experience, and you're touching on something that I talk about all the time, and it's very much appreciated, because I think you're talking about something that we stay alive for, and that is the mystery.
Yeah,
that is the idea that you can say, it's kind of like when you look at somebody in a picture and they go, they're not that attractive or whatever. And you go, you got to know the person. You got to know that girl to know how sexy she is. She may not look good in pictures, but man, when you're around her and you smell her and you see the way she moves. And
smell
you see,
is so and important lust and
very
attraction.
Much so. Yeah.
And think of lingerie. I mean, if you're wearing lingerie, you're perhaps not seeing someone naked, but it's more enticing than just this sort of the naked form. There's that desire, that mystique, the mystery that comes into it.
But that's what wine, when you open a great bottle of wine, it's like seeing a beautiful woman in lingerie or even in clothes, and you know you're going to get her naked eventually. I mean, I hate to say it, man, but that wine...
It's a strong motivator.
It is, brother, because that wine, that wine is going to change and it's going to breathe, and a lot of times it'll take 2 hours before you really taste it to its full potential. And by the way, a wine that comes out in 2010, and especially your wines, Robert Parker talks about letting those wines age for 20 years in the bottle. So that's a whole different experience. So sometimes you got to keep the clothes on the lady for a long time. Then again, she might get really old and wrinkly. And if you're into that, that's fine. But it really is very similar to that. I mean, it's a little bit like Matthew Arnold, who had this debate with Aldous Huxley, who is Darwin's bulldog. Matthew Arnold was a philosopher, and he said Huxley was talking about how human beings came from the sea, and they started as protozoa, and then they were monkeys, and then we became humans, and he was just equating human beings as animals. And Matthew Arnold said it may be true. I mean, science is a beautiful thing, and there's who's to say evolution isn't a beautiful explanation for where we got here, but it misses the point because human beings are not monkeys. They're not so smart monkeys. Human beings are those mysterious creatures that make beauty for beauty's sake, that create things like the Parthenon and the Acropolis and Shakespeare and Beethoven and Mozart and C.V. Wine and talk about the beauty therein. And there are words we use in our language like wonder. And that I don't want you to explain. If my father said, "I love your mother," I could never tell you why I love her. She drives me up a fucking wall. I could give you her qualities, but a lot of people have qualities like that. But I love her, and I don't know why, and I've always loved her.
Mm-hmm.
That's the world I choose to live in. You can break me down into my mathematical biology. You can give me a number with my genome, and it's all great. I love it. I thank God for science. Thank God for the scientific method. Thank God for rationalism and reason. I don't want to live in just that world.
There would be a terrible place. I mean, that would be a form of hell. I mean, not having relations, not having experience, not having feeling.
Mm.
And sometimes it may take the whole range of feeling. I mean, you can know great things, but to know a little bit of pain, a little bit of suffering sort of heightens the positive, heightens the thing that you're most excited about.
Well, you were talking about how your days when you're in harvest season, where you're working 7 days a week, 16 hours a day, and you can't even keep weight on because you're just working. So it's such a manual process.
Yeah, a goal for this year is 8,000 calories a day. I think if I hit a full can of coconut milk in the coffee in the morning and keep it on, goal is to not
literally
lose weight.
So you have to, you cannot eat enough.
That's how it is. I mean, it's, you know, fortunately it's only a month and a half, but
and I should mention Jim Duane is shredded. He's got long muscular arms. And tight cropped hair,
chimp-like arms.
Can I
answer your question about the
please
the money?
Please.
I mean,
Harlan versus CV.
Well, I'd like to see your wallet first.
Yeah.
And I think what it ultimately comes down to, and I've sort of come to this over years of thinking about it and wondering, like, why are some wines great? Because it's not apparent on the surface, and I think the first step is to have a wine of intent. So for us, we're working with 40 acres of grapevines, growing grapes exclusively for our wines. So we know every grape on our ranch is going to go into one of our wines. It's known where it's ultimately going to end up. We are growing it with the intent of making this specific wine that represents only this specific little piece of earth. It's sort of a hyper focus.
Mm.
So I think the wines coming from an estate, wines that are being grown year after year in the same place, going into the same wine where you know where those grapes are from. Perhaps you know the people making those wines. You have that cumulative experience, that very specific sense of place. That, to me, is the best start to make a great wine. And then there's chance. I mean, people go and plant vineyards all over the world. Some turn out to be great, and some not so much. It's a bit of a crapshoot.
Mm.
People have spent untold amounts of money over millennia trying to find the best sites on earth.
Talk about the things that can go wrong with wine making.
Sure.
I mean, you're watching for everything.
Yeah, I mean, first of all, it's an agricultural product. So you're growing grapes in the vineyard. You're at the whim of weather, animals, volcanoes, if you're in Italy. I mean, it could be, you don't know what's going to come in the vineyard. I think we're pretty fortunate in Napa to have really stable weather. But then bringing grapes into the winery, we have to deal with labor shortages and trying to get enough people to pick our grapes. And then once in the winery, we're putting grapes into a tank and we're going to let them sit. And essentially what we're doing is I'm waiting for yeast to grow and take over and run the fermentation. And that's a real risk. I mean, you can have certain strains of yeast that are going to go rogue and give some off flavors in the wine.
Damn,
you have
to have
very, very clean equipment.
Mm.
So it's a lot of management. Essentially, my job is a lot like a babysitter harvest, sort of watching everything, making sure nothing gets out of line.
It's kind of a symphony, isn't it? It's kind of like making sure everything is in harmony.
Right, and it's to me, one of the greatest.
I just wanted
sins.
To say symphony. Just like coming up with really poetic, shitty analogies. Keep going.
It's great to have the very cyclical nature of the work. I mean, I couldn't work in a desk job where I did the same thing in the same place day after day. But to be, you know, working all out on my feet during harvest, it's great. It's hard. But then that ends. Then we get into the calm season of winter where we're going to be working in the cellar. And then within the month, March, the grapes are going to start growing again. So we're going to move outside and spend most of our time.
I've often said that I'd love to own a vineyard. But what I'm really probably saying is that's bullshit, because that means I'm the gentleman farmer who gets to watch everybody do the work.
You'd like to have the Brian Callen wine.
I'd like to have the Brian Callen wine. Like they go along with the Brian Callen show, which, by the way, it couldn't be a worse name for a wine. Brian Callen. I think that when I say I'd like to own a vineyard, what I'm really saying is I think I'd like to do what you do. I mean, I just think that's really what it is. That's what making wine is. I mean, you can't get me out of a wine store, because I love talking to the guy about, you know, the wine and, you know, where it comes from and why it's good. And sort of certain wine is very minerally because it's grown in rock versus, you know, the other stuff. And that's kind of what... It just fascinates me. It's a living food.
Right, and there's no other food or drink that has the same sort of mystique, the same sort of allure. Mm. I mean, you have beer from all over the world, and people love different types of beer, but people don't go crazy and blow millions.
Yeah, because beer, right, I was going to say, beer is, you know, if you make a really good beer, it's going to be $12 a bottle. You know, whereas wine can be $1,200, $2,000, and you get it. You kind of understand it. But I do.
One of the very cool things also about wine is you have the spectrum of, I mean, think of the word wino. Wino could be a homeless guy drinking some $2 plonk that, you know, because the wine was cheaper than water. Or wino can also mean that the billionaire that that's his passion, that's his hobby.
It's also been around forever. Wine has been around since the Greeks, since the Romans. I mean, since the Greeks. I mean, literally, if you read the dialogues, and I always tell people to Socrates and Aristotle and all of them, I mean, Plato and those at the symposium, when they'd get together, everybody would be drunk by the end of the night on wine. When they excavated Pompeii, there's a famous story about finding wine that had been there for 2,000 years. I don't remember when Pompeii was. Somebody tell me, somebody tweet me, but it was, I'm sure you could look it up, but I think it was thousands of years ago. And they found wine and honey both intact. There was wine that had been sealed off by the pyroplastic blast that the volcano had done, covered everything in ash, and they kept the wine in these, you know, the in jugs of wine in these sort
like
of
the amphora,
little clay, you know, ovens, if you will, or little cubby holes.
They were cubbies.
So they weren't ovens, but the wine was drinkable after all that time.
So I mean, that's the wine that I would want to get with. With your $10,000, I want to taste the wine
that the
Romans had. To me, that's the ultimate experience that no one I know has tasted that wine.
They have open bottles that are from the 1700s and stuff, right? I mean,
and I'm sure it's terrible.
Yeah,
but to taste it, I mean,
it's living. You can drink something that was around when Jefferson was walking the earth. You know, that's a big deal to me. I mean, I would absolutely drink that wine.
And
ochratoxin and everything. I don't give a shit, Dave Asprey. You know,
hopefully the ochratoxin breaks down over the millennia. But
yeah,
I mean, the wine is alive. It is living. And we know that because some of those old bottles they found, like people, microbiologists can take those wines, try and plate them, and they still find yeast that can sort of come, they're not just rehydrating, but they can, you know, they form spores and they weather all this time and then they can...
Well, you know, bread makers will not only keep their yeast, they'll pass it generation to generation.
Sure.
So you keep that strain of yeast... That makes your bread special, and grandmothers will that yeast to their granddaughters, who will that yeast, and that's how it was done.
Right. Well, in the winery, we call it the goût de maison, the sort of the flavor of the house.
Oh, really?
And so for us at harvest,
goût de maison,
goût de maison,
maison being house, goût.
I'm not having to add yeast to ferment our wines. It's endemic. It's in the walls. It's in the air. And it does have, I think, a little bit of a sort of character that's unique to this place. Right. Yeah, to this winery, to the barrels.
That's fascinating. So there is a sort of a yeast strain. I mean, at least that would be what you'd want to believe.
I think it's a slew of different yeast and organisms. I think we sort of have this idea, and I think this all comes from yogurt, unfortunately, that there's the acidophilus craze of, you know, have this one bacteria and it'll be great for you. You know, you have these bugs in your stomach, and we've identified, I don't know, but people talk about the 10 different species of different bacteria in your gut. I think in 50 years from now, we'll look back and just laugh at how silly we are about the millions of different sort of species and players in this game that we thought we were.
Well, the forefront of science now, there are doctors, literally, scientists studying the bacteria and fungus and molds that live in your body.
Oh, like the eubiome?
Yes.
That's so cool.
And so your body, and so the future of medicine would be to learn how to foster the good bacteria and hold back the bad bacteria and actually treat your body like it's its own ecosystem, which it is. It's sort of a wildlife habitat that you have to, you know, you have to manage your bacteria and all those sort of pathogen, not even pathogens, but those organisms,
right?
As if they were, you know, I don't know, the Kalahari Desert.
But I think it's even dangerous to start referring to them as good and bad. It's too black and white.
Right.
I think, you know, the populations rise and fall depending on what you eat. So if you're eating a lot of meat, you're going to have the bacteria that are very good at breaking down the lipids. Or if you were to stop eating meat, I mean, I've heard that you can see this even within a couple of days. If you start eating just a lot of carbs and carbohydrates, different populations of bacteria in your gut are going to build up to sort of handle the, you know, the cellulose and all that material. So it's so vast. I think we just barely seen sort of the tip of the iceberg. And, you know, I think the tip of the iceberg was Acidophilus, and it's...
Yeah, you're right.
It's cute.
Yeah, it's cute. That's right. Even Asprey was talking about how there are different kinds of Acidophilus. There's, you know, some actually will make you fat, and the others will not. I mean, obese people have different kind of bacteria in their body.
Right.
And the way they make them skinny sometimes is literally putting shit from a skinny person into their colon.
Do you know which way that tube goes?
I would imagine it goes straight up the ass. I hope, and not down your, you know, in the other way. But
that's such a cool, and call it technology, if you will, but technique. I mean, I think maybe we don't fully understand it, but we know that if you do transfer some of those species, you can really improve someone's health. And that's so cool to me. I think that's a huge field that's going to really blow up in the next, I don't know, but we're going to learn how important those things are.
Yep. I agree 100%. What does, and let's talk a little bit about how you started making wine. Because you grew up in Utah, and being the alcoholic that you clearly are, you started making your own beer.
Yeah, so being 17 in Utah and looking like you're 12 years old never helped, you know, bumming beer in front of the gas station.
Yeah.
But there's essentially, you know, a couple ways to get beer. One is to drive to Wyoming at the border and try and buy a keg and haul it back, which is dangerous. And the other is to make your own.
Right.
So I began sort of making beer from kits. And actually, the first beer I made was this. My uncle gave me a kit and sort of got me going. It was this porter. It was this dark beer. And my friends and I, we drank it because, you know, we could get drunk. But we were just pushing it down our throats. It was just the grossest thing ever because we're used to Keystone Light and Natty Light. And all this flavor was just too much. I actually had a bottle of that later, a couple years later, I'm like, oh,
not a bad porter,
like, rather impressive.
I mean, porter will get you drunk quick.
and from there, it just sort of evolved. I started experimenting, or just fermenting everything that I could find that had sugar.
Wow.
And kind of stumbled onto wine. And for me, wine was very alluring because not only are you making something that's, it's a very long-term process, very involved, but you have the seasonality to it.
Mm.
And that just, to me, with that clicked, to work with plants, to be outside. We make wine one time per year, you know, as opposed to beer where you just start a new batch when you're done with the last.
Mm.
You really have sort of a tie to the world, to the seasons. And to me, that's just very alluring. So I knew at 17, like, okay, if I can do it, got to get out of Utah, but that's what I want to do.
Would you be, how would one, if I'm in jail and I plan on being, how do I make my own wine?
All right. So you have to get all your buddies to save your fruit.
Okay.
From the chow hall.
Okay.
And I actually learned this from Russell, who I worked with in at a winery in New Zealand, because he'd done some a lot of time in minimum security prisons.
Okay.
Taught me many things. I know how to sneak hookers into that prison, but
if you're ever in jail in New Zealand, that'll be the next podcast.
Russell was a wealth of information, but yeah. So you got to get a bucket somehow. Mm. You're gonna have to pay a guard. I'm not sure where you're gonna get your bucket, but okay. You don't want to do it in the toilet.
No.
You got to get all the fruit you can, and you got to smash it up, add a little bit of water, and hiding it is going to be the big issue. For Russell, he put it in the rafters up above his cell, but you know that's minimum security. So, but one of the great things about fermentation is it happens. It takes care of itself. You know, you might not make the most beautiful...
But you just let it sit there.
Juice. Let it sit.
For how long?
Depends, but if you have it warm, it's probably going to ferment within a couple days. I mean, yeast are everywhere.
So in a couple days, I got something that'll get me drunk.
Well, in a couple days, it'll start fermenting. You need a couple weeks to sort of ferment through.
And can I leave it in a plastic bag?
Yeah, if you're not worried about the BPA, which probably not going to be a big issue in prison.
Not in prison, brother. I'm just worried about getting shanked. That's amazing. So that's all it takes. And I could do the same thing if I get my hands on grapes.
Grapes are special for a couple reasons. One being the sort of the acidity, the acid in grapes. So tartaric acid is found only in grapes. Grapes and geraniums, Pelargonium, okay. the geranium species.
Right.
And there's really no living organism, no microorganism on Earth that can metabolize tartaric acid.
Mm.
And so that means the wine can retain its acidity. It's sort of a natural microbiological defense. So wine's quite acidic. I mean, you can see working with wine, it ruins my hands. I look like kind of like a grease monkey.
Your hands are permanently stained.
Yeah.
Wow. Let me see that.
Yeah. And it'll get,
I'm going to take a picture of that and I'll post that on...
I'll send you a picture during harvest too.
Oh, yeah.
It looks terrible.
Send me a picture. Yeah, it's great.
But so grapes have this acidity from tartaric acid. And it's going to keep the wine sound because having that acidity, the alcohol, it's protected essentially. Mm. So you're not going to make good hooch, but it'll get the job done.
It'll get the job done.
You're going
to
be very popular.
So what I would really need in jail is to sneak in one of those barrels, one of those French oak barrels.
Yeah.
And if I'm doing a lot of time, I could find an oak tree somewhere in the yard.
And I'll ship you in some wine glasses and maybe
cut
like
the planks
ascot.
Up. Let them sit there. They tell everybody to keep away from my planks for 3 years, then toast it, then fill it with your grapes because you'd send me some grapes, and then we'd be all right.
Yeah. That would be very unique marketing. You would be able to sell this wine.
From prison. I call it prison. I call it the big house. My chateau would be the big house. Do you think it's changed your, it sounds like making wine has changed your outlook on, when you speak about it, like the way you're speaking about not reducing things, you sound almost religious.
It takes a certain person to make wine. I think that, I don't know how I would describe myself, but the opposite of type A, the opposite of analytical.
Well, because it can't be rushed.
Well, it can be rushed, and because I'm going to put grapes in a barrel or a tank and walk away, I have to have faith that that's going to take care of itself. So, you know, imagine.
So you can't be too controlling in a weird way.
Right. So I studied biology as an undergrad, and I had friends that were going to try to be doctors, and some of them went to work at pharmaceutical places. And to me, that's the worst job on earth, because not just the paperwork, but you have to be so analytical, so perfect about everything, watch every detail to manage everything. It's sort of arrogant that you're having full control of everything.
Mm.
Where with wine, you got to let go. You got to be the person that, you know, is willing to let it be what it's going to be. And it takes some experience to develop that.
Well, this also strikes me as such a truth to wine. You can tell if wine's good because it goes away. You can tell it's not so good. I don't care what they say if it sits in the glass.
Yeah, yeah. I mean,
you
know, that's
like that Caravina I've already finished. And if you don't mind handing me that bottle, I'd like to pour a little more of this. This is a 2010, and it is just heaven. And the, but so are the cabs, man. This is a I'm gonna have to call you and get some bottles from you, and I'm gonna pressure you for the discount, right?
Love to do it.
Yeah, man. I mean, if you guys want a really good wine, I mean, that wine that really it's gonna cost you some money, but that you'd put in your cellar for a long time. CV cabs are where to go.
Can we try something with this? A little experiment.
Yeah.
Okay. So you have the glass in front of you.
Yeah.
Now, if you were to take the glass and you're going to smell it like you're you know, a British sommelier.
Which I always act like.
So when as you're breathing this in, that is the orthonasal sort of perception of the wine.
Yeah.
It's coming through your nose. Mm-hmm. Once you take it in into your mouth and swallow it, keep your mouth closed and breathe through your nose.
Okay.
And you will continue to
keep
taste.
With the wine in my mouth.
Well, you can swallow it.
Okay.
Swallow it, but keep your mouth closed and breathe in and out through your nose. And you continue to taste the wine, and that's back in your in the back of your nose, in the back of your mouth.
It's amazing.
That's the retronasal portion, and to me, that's where the experience comes.
There's
in.
No doubt.
That's where
I don't do
you
that enough.
Understand? The
I don't.
Wine.
I've been drinking wine for 25 years. I don't do that
right,
enough, man.
Right. So the people sort of swirling the glass and talk about it. It can be nice. It's part of the experience, but you got to get it in your mouth. You got to feel it. So I want to do something, if we could,
please.
So this is 2010 Caravina, which is it's a Cabernet, but for us it's a unique blend that's a little bit more supple, a little bit more youthful and intense fruit, something we bring to the market and people can drink when it's young.
Yeah.
So, okay, take the glass, do a quick smell, put it into your mouth, and then close your eyes. And I sort of want to, I'll talk you through this.
And but don't swallow it?
So, no, do swallow
it. Okay.
Do swallow it, but then keep your mouth closed. Mm-hmm. And I want you to breathe slowly through your nose so you're continuing to smell it. But close your eyes. Because for me, my experience with this wine in that retronasal perception in when it's in my mouth, in my nose, it reminds me of being a child and being in my mother's house and opening this drawer of she had a drawer of spices. Most of them were 35 years old, absolutely needed to be thrown out. But the combination, the melding of all those spices coming together, and I'm not going to tell you what specific spices they are because your own experience of those spices is personal to you. And to me, that melding, that warm kitchen with that spice box open,
no
everything
doubt.
Coming together, that's my experience with this wine. And that's I don't want people to have that exact experience, but I want people to be able to build their experience.
Well,
that's
for the first time when I did that, I tasted vanilla.
Okay.
In this wine. It was the first time. And it was loud and clear, by the way. And I've never really done that. But that's, see, look, man, it's talking this way. This is what's amazing. You're talking about taking your time and paying attention.
Mm-hmm.
You know, wine, and especially wine this good, forces you to be mindful. It's what the
Absolutely.
Buddhists call being mindful. it just because when you know you took us through this whole process of how you make the wine,
mm-hmm.
and you get such an appreciation for how much effort, how much physical effort went into making just this glass. Obviously, that's why you pay a lot for one bottle because
sure.
it's, you know. But then when you make me do that, it really does. It's just a different experience, man. And it keeps changing. So I think I have a heart on. Wait a minute. No. Sorry, that just popped out.
So
no,
can we do this on one of the other wines?
Yes.
Flip the tables and have. Do you think you could do a description of your experience?
Yes.
All right.
You want to do that with the 03?
Yeah.
All right, let's do that.
So we have
the
03 CV Cabernet.
You're not looking at this wine for under $150, just so you people know. All right, and I'm talking retail. Am I right about that?
$250
for the 03. So I'm drinking a $250 bottle of wine. What do you have any restaurants that these wines are available in?
Very few in St. Helena. Just
so it's all in Napa. It's not in L.A. or in New York.
There's a couple restaurants in L.A., but
do you know what they are?
I could look it up for you. I don't know off the top of my head.
Because I know all of them.
The one restaurant, Press, in St. Helena, has all the vintages of CV back to 1990.
Wow.
Yeah, so probably the only spot on earth where you could go and drink 20 bottles of wine.
Here goes my experience.
Okay, so I'm going to close my eyes because I want to experience your experience. Do we all have to take our pants off?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I think it's very important.
Okay.
You see, it's such an all-encompassing thing, and I'll tell you what comes to mind is just a bunch of flowers. Mm-hmm. It's a floral wine. It's the closest I can think of coming to eating just a bouquet of flowers, not roses, but all different flowers.
That's awesome.
It's impossible to drink that wine and not get hit with all the colors of the rainbow. Right. I sound like I'm doing mushrooms, but
that's fun. That's honestly you coming into the wine, being a part.
Yeah,
of
I suddenly saw all the colors of the world that matter.
Mm-hmm. So.
And when I say that, I mean black, white, I mean yellow, I mean the Chinese.
Can I tell you mine?
Yes.
On this one?
Yeah.
For me, this wine is Steven Spielberg calling you up on the phone saying, Brian, I need you to come down to my house. We're going to shoot this thing.
Right.
You're my guy. I need you to come.
Right.
And so you got to
get into a dinosaur suit.
Yeah. And he says, okay, come into this room. And you walk into this room and it's just lined with cedar. It's just the walls, the floor. It's this tall room. It's all cedar and it's warm. It's sort of welcoming. He says, okay, he's got the camera. He walks out the door and says, oh, we'll be over here. You just stand there. We're going to shoot from here.
Yeah. You stand there and you just move around naked. Right. We'll go from there. He's in a robe.
And you hear a click. Right. And then just from the ceiling drops 40 tons of rose petals, and they're falling on your head, and you can't help but smell it. I mean, you're sort of swimming and
so you have the same floral experience.
It's absolutely floral. But then he says, okay, now keep going, and you hear the second click, and you get strawberries and blueberries sort of dropping on your head. And again, I don't want to get reductionist.
But I don't know why you had to bring Spielberg into this, for Christ's sake. I mean, you had to have him with a camera. It's just so perverted.
Well, we want to get this, in the
can. Yeah, you could have just said it just feels like rose petals and like, but I mean.
But I want 40 tons of rose petals.
Well, so he has the money visceral for it, so that's why he brought him in. Okay. Only Spielberg could afford 40 tons. All right. Yeah.
Plucked by virgins.
But it's interesting you say that because when you talk about things falling on your head, there is wine like this does continue to change, man. The taste keeps on going. There's a ripple effect to it.
Right.
Again, that's what I hope we're doing a good job of explaining why you spend so much money on a bottle of wine, because it's an experience.
Well, hopefully you can at least help justify the expense to your wife.
Well, also, yeah, exactly. And here's the other thing about this: you can't explain it with words. Right. I mean, actually,
words are limiting.
Yeah, words are limiting. They kind of fall short. So we're trying to do this and explain it. But again, thank God you can't explain everything with words.
Right. Well, I'm a huge Joshua Foer fan.
Oh, dude. So you did you hear the podcast?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. And it just makes so much sense that if something is to be memorable, it has to be visceral. You have to see the colors, hear the noise. Just feel it in as many ways as you can.
He's talking about the book Moonwalking with Einstein. I did a podcast with Josh Foer, who won the American Memory Championships, even though he has a perfectly ordinary memory. And the way you memorize is, and it's never changed, is people associate memory with, I believe, place.
So and in the memory palace, you have different places where you sort of set your memory, but those individual memories, for you to be able to access them, they have to be memorable. They have to be visceral. They have to involve emotion or feeling.
An image, right?
Image is very popular.
Yeah, very striking image. Yeah.
Yeah. But, I mean, you can't say, there's a little cat. I mean, you got to have a 400-pound cat that's gnawing your head off. And he's black and he's clawing at your face. That's what you're
That's what you remember. That's right. And you associate that and you put that. And people will memorize they can memorize the entire encyclopedia using their body parts.
So cool.
You know what I mean? So their thumb, the top part of their thumb is, you know, if they have to remember all the battles of World War II, they'll put them on their hands. And it's a really good book.
Very cool book. And for me, that helped it click of this is what I want to build. We're building an experience.
Yeah.
But you have to have your own experience for it to be memorable.
His brother wrote a great book called Extremely Loud and Incredibly Close, which is a masterpiece.
Okay.
And he was 29 or something when he wrote it.
I have to write that down.
That's a masterpiece.
Wow.
It's a masterpiece. For somebody of his age, he was in his 20s when he wrote it. It's just not done. It's not done. I've talked to really good authors who say it's just astounding. So anyway, that family is rather smart. What were we talking about?
Can I hit on the so you were talking about when you're drinking wine, you're sort of, it's not meditating, but you get, I think you can get that same sort of benefit of being mindful. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's, you know, half the reason that, that red wine especially has these so-called health benefits. And no one's ever been able to sort of put their finger on and say, well, you know, what is the compound in the grape or the wine that confers this health benefit? And tannins and anthocyanins and flavonoids often get thrown out, but it's, to me, it's still unclear. It's more correlation than causation. And I think...
I love hearing you say that.
What is missed is the fact that when you're sitting down, you're opening a bottle of wine, first of all, you're probably with people that you care about.
Yep.
Right? And it's the 30-minute vacation. It's the stress relief. You had a shit day. You didn't yell at anyone at work, and you're going to reward yourself by sitting down and having something beautiful for...
You know, man, that makes so much sense. We spend so much time trying to come up with the nutritional, chemical reasons wine's good for you.
It's arrogant.
When, in fact, what's probably making you healthier is exactly what you said.
Stopping.
Take your
down.
Time. You got to open that bottle, let it breathe, drink it, get right. that warm feeling, and have a fucking conversation with somebody like we're doing.
I mean, that's what you remember. In the end, right? Yeah. I mean, the people, the slow.
I love you, Jim. sorry, that just popped out. You're right, though. I never thought of that.
Well, I will always associate the O3 with Brian Callen's love.
That's what I'm talking about, brother. That's what I'm talking about. That's what I'm looking for out of you, young man. And I'm glad you reached out, though, because, you know, Jim came to my stand-up in San Francisco.
That was a lot of fun. Thank you.
I'm glad you came. Love those crowds. But that's such a privilege about doing a podcast like this, because I try to interview people that matter, that are smart and that are doing things that I'm interested in. Because actors and comedians are some interesting people, but... You know, there are a lot of people out there that nobody talks to or nobody's heard of that are doing amazing things that make our world a better place, including people who make wine. And so it's, I guess, what's a privilege. I give the money that I make on this podcast, you know, that it goes to other things. It goes to my producer and people like that who are well worth it. And I haven't made any money on this podcast. I think I've done 103 episodes, but it doesn't matter because I get to come out here and do stuff like this and talk to really smart, interesting people, you know?
And I got to say thank you, because for me, I spent a lot of money on college and grad school, and with my iPod and listening to podcasts, it's my second education.
Yeah.
I mean, it really is. And it cost me the iPod.
Yeah. Well, that's why I'll never charge for, you know, people, you know, I've had to, well, you should charge a certain, I just believe in putting it out there for free. I appreciate it, man. I don't think the idea is to make money on it at all. I, even sponsors, I've had opportunity to get sponsored by certain like vitamin companies and things like that. And a lot of money, one guy offered me a lot and I said, look, dude, I can't hawk your vitamins.
Was that hard to do to forego the?
No, okay. Not even a little bit hard because I don't consider it, it should never even enter your mind, because I said, if you can show me double blind studies that prove your vitamins work, then we can talk, but you can't.
It's hard to do.
And so then I'm not going to be able to hawk your product if, you know, So that may sound like a noble thing, but it's actually selfish, because if you follow that truth, if you just keep doing what you believe to be right, what you gain from it is authenticity.
Yeah.
And what you gain from it is you get access to people that you wouldn't get access to otherwise, and it's much more enriching. There are no shortcuts.
That's just like so wine. Cool in listening. I mean, people that I would never have heard of in any other venue to hear them, I mean, whether they've had a book and you get to...
Well, this is all Hunter Motz. I'd love to take credit for it. I take very little credit. Hunter is the guy who finds these people and comes to me and goes, what do you think? I mean, I've suggested maybe three. Hunter's a monster. He's such a badass.
He's knocking it out.
I'm just lucky. You're talking about a Harvard grad, biochem grad who speaks nine languages. You're reading his book right now, The Straight A Conspiracy. There's nobody with a thirst for knowledge and life like Hunter.
Yeah, I was telling Brian, it's the book I wish I had in high school. I had that fear that closed my brain down.
Right. Learning is about the emotional state you're in. We're talking about emotion.
Yeah.
The emotional state you're in when you approach it.
Absolutely.
Most of us have these blocks on what we're good at and what we're not good at. And it's ridiculous.
And I mean, I think I told you in email, but my favorite interview you ever had was Kurt Schwengel,
yeah,
the kindergartner teacher.
Yes.
And when I first heard you introduce him, I'll give him 5 minutes before I close this. That was awesome.
Teacher.
That was so cool.
Yeah. I think he got like 40,000 downloads or something.
Oh, he was
man.
A stud.
Yeah, he's a stud, man. He's a stud. Works with kids and makes it fun, you know? And people fight to get their kids into his class. But, you know, not even my daughter made it in the class. She's got another one. I love the teacher, but it's a different thing. Do you think, as you have a daughter and you're about to have another kid, are you, do you see passing the skill on, or are they just going to let them find their way, I guess?
Raising a kid, my daughter's four, raising a kid has been, anyone knows the frustration, who's had a kid knows the frustration of your child not doing what you want them to do, and not just on the long term, but nodding in their dinner, not playing well, not sharing. I think you got to leave it open. You got to give them the best sort of varied opportunities to find something that they're excited about.
Sure.
I'm very thankful that my parents did the same thing for me. Mm. I mean, my father had a business repairing organs.
Wow.
Musical organs.
Wow.
When I was a kid, and it would be my hell to sort of take that torch.
You got a problem with your organ?
Yeah.
First of all, your clientele are just old people from the 1800s.
I mean, he had to end the business because the old ladies died off ultimately, and they just
nobody has a fucking organ problem.
So I'll always be thankful for my parents to letting things be open. My father told me when I went to college, he said, "Jim, you can study anything you want, get a degree in whatever you want. It's totally open. So long as you get a degree also in science, engineering, or business."
Is that right? That's kind of smart, though.
Well, you wanted me to get out and get a job, so.
Yeah.
Yeah. But if I wanted to triple major, that was open.
But you're kind of working in a business that has very, very limited openings, aren't you? I mean, to be a winemaker?
Yeah.
And especially a winemaker on such a small vineyard for such a ridiculously good wine?
I think at this point in time, there's 200 wineries in Napa, 400 brands, but 200 sort of physical wineries. So
you're one of 200.
Yeah, but then also think of...
It's a little bit like being a stand-up comic. There are not a lot of comics out there, especially on my level, ladies and gentlemen. Come see me in Minnesota and or Portland, Oregon. I think I'm going to be in Portland, at Helium. That's my little plug. Keep going.
The punchline tonight, right?
Punchline tonight, but this won't be released until
right.
I think a couple days. I'm not sure. But anyway.
But I mean, okay, let me ask you this.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of wine that gets made in California, and it's the number one wine producing state in the U.S. Mm. What percentage of wine from California do you think comes from Napa Valley?
What percentage of wine comes from Napa Valley in the United States?
Of California's total wine production, what percentage do you think is just Napa?
Okay, well, there's Sonoma.
Right.
There's the areas down, you know, outside of L.A. I would say, I'm going to say that it's a very small percentage. And the reason I'm going to say it's a small percentage is because Napa wines are expensive.
Sure.
So I'm going to take a guess, mm-hmm. and it's going to sound like I'm crazy, but I bet you if you told me it was less than 10%, I wouldn't be surprised.
It's 4.
There you go.
4%.
4%.
Yeah.
Yeah.
California's a big state, and there's a lot of wine that comes from that Central Valley.
And this is very expensive, good wine, yeah.
Yeah, so it's really a small piece on earth.
I
mean, Napa is 1/8 the size of Bordeaux.
It's 1/8 the size of Bordeaux, and
right.
I've been to Bordeaux.
Right, right. By volume, there's not a lot of wine coming out of Napa Valley, which makes it, you know, a little bit more special.
Which is also makes it a little bit more expensive.
It's a lot more expensive.
Napa wine is expensive.
Right.
In a restaurant or anywhere.
But, you know, that's good motivation to take on a second job, mm-hmm. remortgage your house.
Mm-hmm.
You got to do.
If I could get all the money back for the wine I've spent in my life, I could buy a house.
I appreciate you paying my salary.
Yeah, brother. Listen, you're worth
it. I don't come
cheap. You're worth it. Your wine is, you've kind of ruined me a little bit here. This wine is as good as it gets. It really is.
It is a problem. Once you trade up, it's really hard to...
It ruins you. Don't drink really good wine. I always say if I made a lot of money, there are two things that would change in my life. I would travel differently. I'd fly first class everywhere or privately because I can't stand planes. I just can't stand the way, and I would drink a very high class wine. That's it. I don't think much else would change. I really don't. What else would I do? I wouldn't own a yacht. I get seasick. I would definitely live in Napa.
It's a beautiful place. Yeah. I mean, it's one of the things I love most about being and making wine here is, you know, I'm a gardener. I can grow vegetables four seasons of the year. It's beautiful.
That's what I want
to
do.
I have one of the most beautiful drives to work coming up the Silverado Trail.
See, Joe Rogan and I talk about getting a farm and growing our own, having a lake and fishing and growing our own food and just living off the land. We want to do a TV show like that, and we might just do that. You know, we've been really seriously talking about it.
Would you get the high fence operation and bring in some wildlife?
You know what, dude? Maybe, and I'll shoot it with a bow and arrow.
From your kitchen window?
Why not, man? Why not? You can kill me an auroch for breakfast. I don't even know what an auroch is, but I know the cow comes from aurochs.
Well, I keep trying to convince my wife how cool it would be to live in a commune, especially now that we have kids.
Yes.
Have sort of a
Can
small
we wife
village.
Swap, though? That's the
yeah,
question.
Yeah, I think we just sort of set the ground rules early
this
on.
Monogamy bullshit. I'm right with you. Especially when the wine starts flowing. Come on. Don't be so possessive. We're brothers.
Yeah, I think ultimately what it's going to be, it's going to be me and you and the wives aren't coming to the commune.
I'm down. Well, you know, we'll end this podcast. Well, this has been amazing. We're at 55 minutes, and this is when you know you love kids. I'm watching your daughter run back and forth, and I literally want to go out there and play with her. She's so cute that I literally, like, I think she's been a distraction. So Jim Duane from CV Vineyards, thank you for doing the Brian Callen Show. Thank you for having me out here and
really
giving me this amazing
it.
Wine and giving me the tour. You're the man.
All right. Appreciate well, and thank it. You for doing the podcast. It's been it's funny. And
now you're a guest. Now you're a part of it.
My education 2.0. So.
Thank you, bro.
Thank you.
Thanks for educating us on wine, man. This has been awesome.
Peace!
You've been listening to The Brian Callen Show with Brian Callen. Be sure to like him on Facebook. Just search for Brian Callen Comedy. And follow him on Twitter. Just search for @BrianCallen. You can also find him online by visiting his website. Just go to briancallen.com. Until next time, bye-bye.